shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight we're going to look at biotechnology and agriculture. First, we'll bring you excerpts from a symposium on biotechnology and food that took place in Syracuse last month. Then, we'll hear about biodiversity and biopiracy from internationally recognized activist and expert Vandana Shiva.
I'm Chris Sturr. Next on Unwelcome Guests, we will hear selections from a symposium on biotechnology and food, which was held last month in Syracuse, and which was sponsored by Cornell Cooperative Extension of Onondaga County.
I'd like to welcome you on behalf of our association and Kathy Dishner, the other Extension educator, and myself. I'm Ed Stair with Cornell Cooperative Extension of Onondaga County. And what we've assembled here today is a very diverse group of presenters to present the latest findings in biotechnology. It's such a complex issue, and we've organized this as an open forum to present numerous sides in this issue. It's not black and white. There are no straight answers, and people may often walk away with more questions than answers after certain forums. But after this, we hope by presenting everything that you, in turn, may make more informed decisions when it comes to biotechnology.
The first speaker at the symposium was Dr. Margaret Smith of Cornell University, who is a half-time faculty member in the Department of Plant Breeding and half-time associate director of Cooperative Extension.
Due to a technical problem, our recording of Dr. Smith's presentation was lost, so I'll summarize the highlights for you as I understood them. She said, DNA carries the genetic blueprints of life. She explained that the genetic code of all life forms is remarkably similar in that there are only four subtypes of DNA which, in combination, make up the genetic instructions for all organisms, whether a fruit fly, a corn plant, or a human being. Scientists represent these code fragments with four letters of the alphabet. The differences between a fruit fly and a human being result, then, from the number and arrangement of these four basic units. Just as all information on a computer ultimately can be broken down to the numbers 1 and 0. On the molecular level, a cell sees a string of instructions consisting of arrangements of these four elements. And from that perspective, nothing differentiates a gene from one organism from that of another. That is why it is possible to insert a gene from one organism into the cell of another completely different organism. For the cell, it's just more code, and it keeps on reading that code along with the code that was already part of its genetic structure. Human beings have billions of sequences of genetic code, while a fruit fly has only a few million. The more complex the organism, the more code sequences. Most people think that animals must be more complex than plants, so it might surprise you to know that a corn plant has a genetic code that is far more complex than a fruit fly's. So from the standpoint of complexity, that is numbers of gene sequences, a corn plant is closer to a human being than a fruit fly. From the scientific point of view, all our food crops have been genetically modified, as they have been selectively bred over several millennia and are now quite different from their wild ancestors. So, scientists use the term genetic engineering to refer to organisms created by the insertion of DNA from one species into the cell of a plant or animal of another entirely different species, which would normally not be able to interbreed, such as a bacteria and a corn plant. Genetic traits are expressed in several ways. In some cases, one gene will contain the instructions for a specific characteristic, such as the production of a toxic substance. In other cases, a trait of an organism results from the interrelationship of many genes, not just one gene alone, and this process is quite far from being understood. Are there risks involved in genetically engineered crops? Yes, and Dr. Smith's view was that GE crops should be looked on at a case-by-case basis with regard to whether the risks outweigh the potential benefits. Thus far, only a few genetically engineered organisms have been commercialized. The first was the production of a synthetic rennet for cheese making, replacing the use of an enzyme taken from the intestines of calves. This synthetic enzyme has been in use for more than a decade. There have also been pharmaceutical applications for genetically engineered substances, such as insulin, which Dr. Smith said has been extremely beneficial for patients suffering from diabetes. Genetically engineered food crops, which have been widely commercialized in agriculture, mainly consist of modifications designed to control pests or to resist herbicides, such as Monsanto's Roundup Ready corn, soybeans, and oil rapeseed. The claim is that these Roundup Ready varieties will reduce the use of pesticides overall and have a positive effect on the environment. Other modifications, such as the Flavor Saver tomato, were designed to allow produce to have a longer shelf life. The Flavor Saver tomato was a commercial failure because it did not taste good. Dr. Smith said that a type of tomato which was not particularly tasty was used as a base crop, and she implied that it was that, not the genetic engineering of the tomato, that led to the poor taste. Dr. Smith's presentation left one with the impression that scientists regard genetically engineering of crops as another type of plant breeding system, along a continuum that includes selective breeding and hybridization, cross-pollinating two different varieties of a plant to create a third, with the best of both parents' characteristics. Techniques that are now called classical breeding techniques, to differentiate them from genetically engineered varieties.
The next speaker at the symposium was Dorothy Rosa Harris, a registered dietitian at Community General Hospital in Syracuse, speaking on health and nutritional concerns with genetically modified organisms.
I think we need to keep Margaret's comment about risks and benefits very much in mind as we go through this part of the program on are there any health concerns with genetically modified organisms in our food. One of the things that I've always felt for years is as I practice as a dietitian, I'm actually looking at patients with my flashlight. And sometimes my flashlight is on for a fleeting second. Sometimes it's on for a longer time period as I try to understand what I about this patient and how to put together their health care program. Sometimes I'm using a very small pen light that's on my keychain. Other times I've got a big enough flashlight that I could be a guard and put a full beam of light on the patient. I want you to keep this illustration a little bit in mind as we go through this information. Our first concern that comes to mind when we start to talk about health concerns here is when we look at food hypersensitivity. Now, I know that all of you recall the ins and outs of normal immune response, that a foreign substance called an antigen triggers the production of antibodies, and those antibodies then fit all around that antigen when it comes into the body again and just destroys it and removes it from the system. The problem that we have when we have an allergic reaction is that it will trigger off a set of inappropriate defense mechanisms. And the term allergy is a very encompassing term. It can mean anything from asthma to hay fever to eczema, and even the most serious is anaphylactic shock. Now, why this becomes of concern in food allergies is that once it's determined that a person has a food hypersensitivity, the only proven theory that we can, or therapy that we can use, is strict elimination of that particular offending allergen. So that when we begin to look at changing food slightly, we need to keep this in mind. How big a problem could this be? Well, we know that 1-2% of people in Western countries have allergy reactions to certain foods types, and 6% of children under the age of 3. We don't really know what the story is in other cultures because the data just has not been able to be collected. The list that physicians generally have available, and I've given you a very extensive list in your handout, lists a lot of foods, and one could quickly look at that and say, well, I guess I can't eat anything if I'm allergic to food. That's why it becomes very important to be very specific. The most common foods that are listed on your handout account for 90% of the allergies in Western cultures: the milk, the eggs, the legumes, the shellfish, the fish, the tree nuts, the cereals. Then we have some less common ones, such as the strawberries, apricots, carrots, celery. That's the physician's list. My list is a little more extensive after practicing dietetics for a number of years, and I note that tomatoes crop up, citrus fruits, pineapple, and then there's those favorites of mine that show up on a lot of people's list called spinach and liver. That's on a lot of patients' list. That one hasn't shown on any physician's list yet. Now, when you start to transfer genes to a food product, the people that have this allergy to that food could still have a problem with it, because most of the new proteins present in amounts that in this new food are still a trace amount, but that trace amount is enough to trigger the physiological reaction. So has this concern shown in any of the GMOs? Yes, it has. We had Pioneer Hybrid did some research to genetically modify the soybean with the goal to include the amino acid methionine. Now, the methionine, the intent here was to make a nutritionally complete soybean by having all of the essential amino acids present. The source of the methionine came from the Brazil nut. Now, you see, as soon as I heard this, I said, did you talk to a dietitian or a physician in doing this research? Because that's one of those, it's a big red flag. And apparently they didn't, or they didn't listen. And sure enough, the people who have a Brazil nut allergy presented with having a problem with these soybeans. The research stopped at that point. Now, as a result of Pioneer Hybrid's work, since 1992, the Food and Drug Administration, or the FDA, has required that GMO foods be tested, and if they are made from a food that has a known allergen in it, and if they cause a reaction, then this food cannot be provided to the public, or is not approved. Likewise, if the plant has a food additive that's not on the generally recognized as safe list, that GRAS list, then the FDA approval of the plant is going to be required. The response that Pioneer stopped the research is often given as an example that the regulatory system of this country worked. However, there is a shortcoming here in that this is only looking at foods that we know are a known allergen at this point. It doesn't talk about those foods that are now being produced by putting non-foods into them, such as bacteria. They're not required to be tested. I'm not quite sure how one would do that testing, and maybe we can find out some from some of the other speakers if that's even reasonable. But it does lead people to sometimes then conclude that the FDA is very much more for the producer than for the consumer. However, there is a benefit side to this in that perhaps the GMO food could begin to produce foods that reduce the allergenic activity. And that has, in fact, occurred with rice. So we may have a benefit here that we were not able to achieve before. The flashlight beam, and I think it's a full beam going forth on this food hypersensitivity, is very real, and it has been recognized by the FDA. Now let's move on to our next flashlight beam, and that would be our antibiotic resistant microorganisms. The marker genes are placed into these crops for a reason. They've been placed into the Flavor Saver tomatoes, and it was an antibiotic. They either used Kenicin, which is a last resort drug that's used to fight multi-resistant tuberculosis, or neomycin. Into the BT corn, they have placed a resistance to ampicillin. Now, they're placed there so that next to the genes, so that the desired characteristic that they're looking for in that particular plant can be linked, and then when the material is treated with the antibiotic, they can pull out the part that they want to keep, the transformed material, from the untransformed material. So it's part of producing this particular product. There have been a number of studies that have claimed that there's no antibiotic-resistant genes have not presented as a risk to humans or animals. However, there is a concern that antibiotic-resistant genes will be transferred to bacteria living in the guts of humans or animals, and that this could reduce the efficiency of antibiotic drug therapy for that person in the future. Now, this is just a very gray area. We've got zillions more questions than answers in this story. We also need to recognize that although we have a fair amount of antibiotic resistance occurring now, and I've seen it grow tremendously in the last 5 years in my own practice, we have to recognize that this is primarily coming about from overuse and misuse of antibiotics. However, I do think it's of note that the FDA has advised food developers to please avoid marker genes that encode resistance to clinically important antibiotics, so that when I read that the antibiotic that was used on the Flavor Saver tomatoes is the one that is kind of a last resort for multi-resistant tuberculosis, I do become a little bit questioning of that decision. Another area of concern would be with toxins. Now, in 1989, we had L-tryptophan that was being produced as a supplement that was pulled from the market after we had 37 people die in this country, and we had another 1,700 that experienced extremely painful muscle disease, and it was traced to the L-tryptophan, or it was believed that this was the problem. And one of the thoughts was that the bacteria became contaminated during the recombinant DNA process and was the cause of the deadly tryptophan. Now, the problem is that we're never going to know the answer to this one because the manufacturer pulled everything and destroyed it. And so that the questions will continue to be out there, and perhaps we are unable to learn any lessons from that terrible situation. But it does kind of raise a flag that once something is developed, we probably need to be assured that there's a quality control program that is continuing to monitor that product so that these kinds of situations do not occur. We've also had in the potato a piece of research that came out that found damage from this genetically modified potato to the internal organs and the immune system in rats. Now, does that make an impact in us? I don't know. The research was reported in Lancet, and they also found a viral infection in the mucosa of the GI tract that was thought to be most likely due to the genetically modified product that was used to produce this plant. Although this particular research was very nicely presented in Lancet, which is, you know, a respectable journal. There was a heavy deal of criticism that came forth on this particular research because it was lacking in too few animals and there were no controls. Lancet did a number of editorials on why they did this because they felt that the issue was so important to begin to get into the medical literature. Part of the concern is that we have undesirable characteristics that are not necessarily being identified. And sometimes it's the producer of this particular GMO organism has done some research, but have they done it in a way that answers the questions? One of the concerns in looking at some of the presentation for the BT corn was that the research has a sense to it that it was lined up so that there couldn't possibly be a negative answer. They didn't even look at the effects of the BT on the rest of the food chain. They only looked at it with a small group of animals, and then that small group of animals, they didn't even really prove whether they got the BT into themselves, so that they were experimenting with animals that may not have been affected at all or been able to absorb it. More research is needed in this area, and I would classify this as a very weak battery and a very flickering flashlight, so we've got a long ways to go in this one. Another area of concern is in nutrient content. We've had a couple of articles come out. One was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition that looked at the nutritional comparison of traditional soybeans and a GMO soybean, and they found them comparable, and they looked at much more than protein and carbohydrate and the vitamins and minerals. We also have had LaPay report that there's a decrease in beneficial phytoestrogens in GMO soybeans versus the traditional strains. But I have to tell you that I'm not even sure what I would do with that information because I'm not at a point of advising people that you're going to need 42 milligrams of phytoestrogens in order to ward off your coronary heart disease. It's like our advances of knowledge is too weak to be able to deal with that information. I will tell you, as a dietitian, I would certainly like to have the GMO products that are made available come forth with nutrient content because, you know, I just want to know every part of it that I can, and I don't want to trust it that it's like the traditional. I want to know for sure. I also find myself thinking back on when, in 1996, when Alestrel came forward. Now, you know, there was a lot of controversy as to whether that product was of any value or not. But I found it very helpful when the manufacturer sent out information that allowed me to even recognize that if a patient had been consuming these wonderful snack foods and then went for a fecal fat content study, that they would possibly have a positive response. I found it nice to know that. At least I didn't look like a turkey. I mean, I didn't know everything about how this thing was going to go, but I didn't have to feel like I was out in a bizarre little world. And I wasn't chasing after some wild goose chase if I had a patient that all of a sudden presented with high fat contents in their fecal fat test. A fifth area is my flashlight beam is looking at cancer. Now, we do know, for example, that the genetically engineered recombinant bovine hormone that's injected into cows to produce a higher amount of milk, that in those particular cows, we began to see an increased amount of insulin-like growth factor, IGF-1. Now, we also know that IGF-1 can survive digestion and absorption in the circulation of rats, and we also know that IGA-1 has been shown to be higher in humans who drink more milk. And we also know that IGA-1 has been shown to increase the risk of several cancers. Whether A plus B plus C gives you cancer, we don't know. There is a need for more research. We also know that in this area, I pose the question that in Roundup Ready pesticide, the Roundup Ready soybeans, that there's a residue in there that's three times the amount that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, allowed if we were traditionally spraying these soybeans. So that, and EPA did go along with the approval of this, but we don't, you know, it's like there's this big question in my mind, is that really going to be okay, or won't we know until more research is done? The last area is in the creation of new viruses. Here our thought process is we now know that DNA is not broken down in the gut as we once thought, so that genes from ingested GMOs could spread to the bacteria in the gut. That's the thought process. Whether that occurs or not, we don't know. So clearly, more research is needed. The last three concerns that I've mentioned, the nutrient content, the cancer, and the creation of new viruses, I think I probably have the pen light on my keychain at that, on those particular situations, and I haven't even been able to unlock my car before the light goes out. So we have a lot of room for improvement here, or for finding information. So my quest to give you an informative, up-to-date presentation has given you a lot of I don't know, and I won't know for quite some time. We have some major concerns in food hypersensitivity and the antibiotic-resistant microorganisms, but the FDA has acknowledged that, and then we have these other four areas of toxins, nutrient content, cancer, and creation of new viruses where we don't have any clear answers. My hope is that our three agencies in this country who overview it are gaining a strength from collaboration and haven't taken the aspect, well, since the other guy's looking at it, I won't get too excited about it. I think that we need to hold a pose that food safety must be ensured as a very core part to this whole issue. I hope I've helped you at least begin to pose the questions.
That was Dorothy Rosa Harris, a registered dietitian at Syracuse Community Hospital, speaking on health risks associated with eating transgenic foods. The next speaker was Jane Andrews, the corporate nutritionist for the Wegmans grocery chain, which is one of the retail outlets that is being targeted in a campaign to label genetically engineered foods. Wegmans is tracking customer concern about GMOs as an emerging issue and discussing how they ought to respond. She said that Wegmans receives about 540 communications from customers each week. Until recently, they received only one inquiry each week of those 540 on the subject of GMOs. By comparison, bovine growth hormone in dairy products was a hot issue in 1994, and Wegmans received a total of 600 customer communications.
What are consumers thinking? What are their concerns and why? Is it more of an environmental issue for them? Is it more of a food safety issue for them? Is it all of the above? And certainly we're trying to look at the human health, food safety, and environmental studies as they come about. A year ago, I was in London and was really impressed by the strength of the passion of folks there, and also became aware of how much controversy there is about what is GMO. They're fighting. If you think that they've outlawed GMOs, they're fighting it. And some retailers are saying, well, you know, if the soybean oil or the corn syrup no longer has any DNA, that must be free of genetic modification. And then other people are saying, no, if it's from corn that was genetically modified, it's then GMO. So they're having lots of difficulty deciding how they will label this. And that difficulty is also very apparent here in the United States as regulators are trying to come up with the standards. And even the tolerance. In Europe, it's 1%. In Japan, it's 5% is acceptable and still call it GM-free. Here's an example of a label from the Netherlands. And again, this is just one of my counterparts who works in Holland showed me a label, and I'm trying to interpret what I thought it was in English. But at any rate, there was asterisks by each of the ingredients, like thiamine, riboflavin, soybean oil, cottonseed oil, and saying that it may include genetically modified product. When we're talking about labeling in Europe, this is kind of what we're talking about. Just so you know, I mean, I was amazed. Oh, that's what it is. And consumers there in the Netherlands had no problem with this kind of labeling. It didn't affect their buying decision at all. And certainly, I don't have any problem with this. I just want the rules to be clear. I want FDA to decide what the rules are, and then we'll follow it. So, if you got anything from my talk, GMO maybe is almost everything, GMO free, who knows? Who knows? And some people say, well, can't you just test? Just do a test and you'll know. Consumer Reports went and did a test, and they showed these corn chips had genetic modified corn in it. Well, there is a company called Genetic ID. There's many companies that are actually testing to find that DNA, that certain strand that shows that it's been genetically modified, and kind of like O.J. Simpson. It takes days. You watch those trials. You know it doesn't come back in a moment. So they've got to check. It's hundreds of dollars every time one of these tests is done. So you can see that it's not something simple for us. There's another company that we've met with a couple of times, wonderful company called Strategic Diagnostics. Now, they've done a much simpler test. This is an immunoassay test. It's dipstick technology, about $5 per test, reliable, qualitative, but it doesn't work with processed foods. And there are no tests, nothing that will test for corn oil, for soybean oil, for corn syrup. Neither of these companies or anybody can look at that can of pop and tell whether or not it was genetically modified or from GM corn. I can tell you, I'm pretty sure it was, just because I know the food system, but there's no test that can tell you that. So that makes it kind of difficult for us when we talk about labeling. Should we or should we not label? We had a meeting with our executives, went over a bunch of things with them, and we looked at the options, and let me just, it's in your packet. We looked at options and thought, well, we could take, and I had this idea when I was in London. I thought, well, why don't we just take our Food You Feel Good About line and make it GMO-free? Well, what I found out after studying is, there's not a test that I can do. I got 540 different suppliers. They don't know what their products are. They're often buying from somebody else. There's not a separate pipeline except for organic. And if I buy organic, I'm going to pay a heck of a lot more. And I don't think my customers are going to pay me for that. So we need a certifiable paper trail. That's not yet in existence. It would take us years to implement if we demanded it from our suppliers, but it would cost us a lot, and we're not sure our customers will pay for it. We could promote organic. When I presented this option to our folks at the executives, they said, hey, wait a minute. The produce department guy said, now, wait a minute. That'd make it seem like the rest of the produce in my department is GM. It's not. He was right. So we thought, well, when a customer asks, or when we write a column for Mary Ellen, we'll talk about this and say that if you're concerned, you can buy certified organic. But otherwise, everything in the produce department is fine. Our decision at this point regarding GMOs is to continue to read, listen, learn, and as with other products, we'll wait and let the marketplace try to take the leadership on this, see what happens, see what customers want, what they tell us is what we'll do, and educate as much as we can. That's why I'm here. So thank you.
That was Jane Andrews, corporate nutritionist for Wegmans Grocery Stores, speaking at a symposium on biotechnology and food safety held in Syracuse last month.
Let me briefly introduce our next two speakers. They will be co-presenting together. This is Lou and Murby Lego, and they are the co-owners of Elderberry Pond Farm. They're full-time fresh market growers of fruits and vegetables. The farm uses organic growing techniques and the latest in integrated pest management practices to ensure the safety of those working on the farm and those buying their produce. Lou is a graduate of Penn State University with an engineering degree and a master's in business administration from Syracuse University, and he was employed for 25 years at General Electric as a research engineer. And he's been a fresh market grower for that same period. He retired 2 years ago and has since been working with some research grants from Cornell, as well as an additional grant to carry out integrated pest management projects to reduce the uses of pesticides. Lou has experimented with many new fruits and vegetables on his farm. He currently grows over 100 varieties of apples, including, and I never heard of these before I heard him speak in November, the rare heirloom and the English cider varieties. He's also many plantings of unusual ethnic vegetables and fruits, including one of the state's first Asian pear orchards. Murby, his wife, is a registered dietitian and a graduate of Penn State with a degree in hospital dietetics, and
University of Iowa with a master's degree in nutrition. She's worked as a research dietitian in the past in the University of Iowa Hospitals, as well as Abington Memorial Hospital in Pennsylvania and Luke's Memorial Hospital in Utica. For the past 15 years, she's worked part-time and now full-time at Aldebaran Pond Country Food Store. In addition to the country food store, the Legos market their produce through the area's farmers market and through a farm subscription program, which some of us know as a CSA, or Community Supported Agriculture.
We're going to talk about some choices that farmers have in terms of GMOs. Why would we be interested in using them, or why might not we be interested in using them? And then Murby is going to talk about consumers and what, as a consumer, you should expect, what information you should expect when you buy directly from a farmer. Should he be able to tell you whether they're GMOs or not, and what other questions might you ask when you do that? So we've sort of split it up in that way. First, direct market farms are, as the name implies, don't sell to anybody that sells to anybody else. Every customer we have in all of our business is someone who comes back to the farm or who we know personally. And so we feel very strongly that we have a responsibility to these people. These are people we know. We've dealt with them for years. They're not going to come back if we mess up. It's not like us selling to someone and where it goes, who knows. It's gone and out of our barn and someone has it, and if they don't like it, we probably won't hear about it. So these farms tend to be small. Between 10 and 50 acres is probably typical. Not a lot of machinery, because you can't afford it at that. Another characteristic of them is that they tend to grow a large variety of crops. Most of the crops in this country today are grown on very highly specialized farms. I was reading the other day that we have the magazine that we get that lists the biggest farms in the country. And most of them are in California, fruit and vegetable farms. Most of them are California. There's 50, 60,000 acres with one crop. One of them's so-and-so brothers in Salina Valley, California, 60,000 acres of lettuce. Every year, lettuce on the same land, 60,000 acres of it planted, cut, sent somewhere. That guy doesn't have a lot of people coming to him saying, lettuce wasn't very good last week. It's kind of a different scheme of farming. In our business, taste and the freshness is the only discriminator we have. We're competing with Wegmans, which have beautiful produce all year, and the only reason we're going to get business, we're going to get business on cost. Our cost is not much better, if it's better at all, than Wegmans. So it's got to be fresher, and it's got to taste better, or we're not going to get the business. And as was mentioned, we sell through three ways, in our store and through a CSA and also in farmers markets. All of these aspects, as I'm going to explain, of direct marketing don't favor small farms and R-sized farms using GMOs for reasons that I'll mention, talk about. A big problem in sweet corn all over the country, becoming a much bigger problem all the time, is European corn borer, which, if you read corn, has a little hole in the husk. Don't take that one. Find another one. Don't pick that one out. There's a European corn borer who's gotten in there and is enjoying the corn before you do. And another one is crops that aren't killed by Roundup. So you can plant corn, wait till the corn's up, see weeds all over the field, spray the field. The corn lives and the weeds die. So it's an amazing spectacle to see, and it's popular around the country as a way to grow corn. And crops with slowed down ripening, there are many varieties, not just Flavor Saver, but there are other tomatoes that have been modified to either ripen slow or have some other characteristic. And then disease resistance is probably the fastest growing, and particularly in cucurbits, in squash and melons, because disease, particularly up around Syracuse, is horrible. Powdery mildew, mosaic disease, all sorts of diseases that attack these crops. All of these features that are mentioned come with what I consider serious drawbacks. If you look at sweet corn and say, well, I want to buy a BT corn, and we get commercial catalogs with all the varieties, and the most common corn, BT corn, is attribute. The problem with it is, one, you have to plant 40 acres and you have to buy 100,000 seeds, in some places 10,000 seeds. So for some reason, it's been limited to super sweet corns in large quantities. So we couldn't buy it on our farm anyway unless we kept the seed for 20 years and planted a little bit every year, which we're not likely to do. And the other thing is, these particular varieties of super sweet corns are not ones you would pick to taste. They're not good, particularly good varieties. Super sweet corns were developed for one purpose. They can be grown in Florida, thrown on a truck, and the sugars don't convert on the way to New York. So when you see Florida corn this time of year, it's almost certainly super sweet, and it's almost certainly GMO corn. There's almost no chance that it isn't. And when you taste it, I don't particularly like it, but it's in the stores and it's better than what used to be because of the both conventional and other plant breeding that's been done to make it ship. The other thing is these seeds are very expensive, and that when you take them and when you use them, there's something always associated with them. There's a string that's attached to planting and farming with these. You have to do this, you have to do that. You can't plant super sweet corns in cool soil. Well, we never get warm soil in New York, so that's a problem. They germinate very poorly. All these crops are not meant for small farms. They're meant for huge single crop farms where if you have 10,000 acres of straight neck squash and it gets a disease, you've got a problem. It spreads like wildfire through the field. We don't have 20,000 acres of squash. We have a couple of rows, you know, and we have 10 different varieties of squash in that row. They're not all going to get the same disease, and so it's not this kind of thing is not geared for small farms. It's not meant for small farms. And the most important thing, and this is something that you get as a farm for a while, is a farm like ours on a small farm has an incredibly complicated and interesting ecological balance. As you farm and as you farm organically for a few years, you start to realize that everything that you think might be out of your control, insect pests like corn borer, and weeds and diseases, are all part of a network. And as you get that farm into a balance, an ecological balance, all those things decline and go away. Your European corn borers, the eggs are eaten by Trichogramma wasps, which if you have enough good weed systems in your farm, not in the fields, hopefully, but around the farm, you will have beneficial insects that will take care of those pests. If you introduce something into that system, a GMO crop or insecticide or anything that's tailored to do one specific thing, you throw that balance off. And when you throw that balance off, you pay for that for years. So that balance that is extremely important on a farm, on a direct farm kind of size farm. Taste and freshness are our discriminator. Almost all the plant breeding, both conventional and genetically engineered and genetically modified breeding, is done for things that we don't care about: chipping quality, size, and color. You just go into the store and look at the stuff that's in there. The peppers that look too big to be possible. And we had some grapes last week were as big as lemons. There are Thompson seedless grapes that, you know, people, wow, that's a big grape. I'm going to get some of those. Most of that stuff doesn't taste very good. The flavor isn't there, and we would have a hard time reselling that stuff. People come back because our stuff has extraordinary taste. So these things, at least so far in genetic engineering, have been tailored for crops. This is an interesting one here. This is a new tomato called Sunbeam. It's in Rogers commercial catalog. You can't read the fine print on there, but what it says is that this tomato packs out well, it's firm, and it begins to ripen uniformly after it's gassed, whatever that means. And you probably don't want to know what that means. But these things are not grown in a field with people picking them and putting them in a basket. These things are picked dead green, put on a truck in a box, gassed somewhere, and then shipped. So it's a different thing than direct market farming. I mean, it's not what I think about as farming. Okay, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Murby. He's going to tell you when you go to a direct market farm, how can you interact with the farmer? How can you find out? There is some possibility that he'll have a GMO crop. How would you sort that out and figure it out?
When you are going to a farmer's market or a farm to buy produce, there are some questions that you can ask. This is if you're concerned about getting genetically engineered foods and if you want to avoid them. And we're just talking about fresh produce here. As you heard before, when you're dealing with foods that might have corn oil in them or soy products in them, that's another whole category. What I'm focusing on here is just fresh produce that you would go to buy. The first thing you should ask is, where was the produce grown? Just because you're buying it at a farmer's market from someone who looks like a farmer does not mean that he grew it. A lot of the farmer's markets, some of the farmer's markets fortunately have regulations that you have to grow. Very few of them actually say that you have to grow everything that you're selling. Most of them say you have to grow a certain percentage of what you're selling. Some of them, quite frankly, you don't have to grow anything that you're selling. So at some of the farmers markets, you're basically dealing with a middleman person. So you be aware of that before you start asking questions. Did he grow it? And then you might want to ask what variety you're purchasing. If he doesn't know what variety it is, there's no way you're going to know if it was genetically modified. Is the variety a genetically modified type? The farmer may not know this, actually. Most of the seeds that we buy, well, we know that the ones we're buying are not genetically modified. But sometimes that isn't obvious from the seed catalogs. Sometimes you might have to actually call the seed company to find out. So it takes a little research. We think that it's the responsibility of direct market farmers to find that out. But not every farmer might know that. The varieties that you might want to keep in mind, if you're asking him what variety it was, these are some of the things that you could potentially find at a farmer's market that might be genetically modified. The BT sweet corn, which has been mentioned several times, the super sweet varieties, Attribute and Yield Guard are some that might pop up, the names. BT potatoes, New Leaf, and you can get these in upstate New York, by the way. We actually got a shipment of these by mistake this year, so we know that they're sending them to upstate New York, some of these New Leaf genetically engineered potatoes. Then some of the squashes also. The Independence 2 and the Zucchini and Independence 3. And the yellow crookneck squash are sometimes genetically modified. Tomatoes, talked about that too. That's another one. And their Flavor Saver and Endless Summer are the two varieties that would be genetically engineered.
First, GMO fruits currently, with the current state of breeding and everything, are not well suited to small farms. They're suited for another intention. They're suited for the produce distribution system that's been set up in this country, where you can grow things in California. Someone in California can grow a cabbage, ship it 3,000 miles through three different distribution centers and sell it as cheaply as I can sell it, going up across the road and picking it. That distribution system is the way things are set up, and it's the reason that plant breeders are breeding plants. And the reason for that is because a lot of that research work comes from funding from large institutions. We're not funding much plant breeding at Elderberry Pond. So that's good and bad. I'm not saying that's all bad or all good, but it's the way it is. That distribution system is driving everything. We have, as direct market farmers, wonderful, very sustainable alternatives to all these things. We don't have cucurbit diseases on our farm. We have traps for European corn borers that work perfectly. And we don't have any of the problems that all these things address. and we won't have them because our farm is being sustained in an ecological way, and it will be that way for the next 300 years. Nothing is going to change that. It's a stable ecological environment, and so we don't need these things. And the final point is that you should question farmers. It's a good thing. It'll be a good thing for farmers. I like it when people in the farmers market come up and say, well, one lady last fall came up and said, are your apples genetically modified? And I had to think about, I'm thinking, well, they were somewhere along the line they were genetically modified. I mean, it all started with one apple, and I'm running all these things through my mind of how to answer this poor woman. And I don't think I just babbled on like I am now, and I don't think she ever got an answer. But I know it's not what we call a GMO in this room, those apples. And finally, buying from direct market growers and processors gives you, we think, the best assurance of knowing what you're getting. You're getting it from us, and you're going to be back to us, and we feel a responsibility to you. And we'll answer any question you have, what pesticides we use, what herbicides, any question you have, we can answer. It's not third hand through who knows where that product came from.
That was Lou and Murby Lego, owners of a direct market organic farm in Auburn, New York.
The final speaker at the Symposium on Biotechnology and Food, held last month in Syracuse, was Tony Del Plato, a member of the Moosewood Restaurant Collective, chef, gardener, homemaker, and activist, and coordinator of the Ithaca Area Safe Food Campaign, a consumer advocacy group which has been active on the issue of genetically modified foods.
I just want to say a disclaimer right off the bat. I'm not here representing Moosewood Restaurant because many people at Moosewood are not sure, just as I think many of you are not sure. And so many individuals at Moosewood support much of the work I'm doing and understand many of the issues. But as a business, as a whole, Moosewood has not taken a stand on this. And it's probably from a business point of view, a prudent decision. I've been studying, reading about GMOs for about 2 years now, and it's incredible how much information there is. But I'd like to say that I've met Margaret Smith a number of times. She's a neighbor of mine, and someone like Margaret and other researchers and scientists I've met have helped to ground me to better understand the issues. I'm still a little suspicious of anyone who says they're on the fence on the issue, because I'm off the fence. I've taken a position in light of the biotech blitzkrieg, and I use this word very seriously because I think language is an important issue here. In light of the biotech blitzkrieg of hype and products, what are the issues that we face as producers and consumers of transgenic food products? Well, there's four primary issues at this point. Language, we consume, but do we know who produces? Taking back our government. Patents. I think those are some of the critical issues. And while a science may be on the fence, or I think in all honesty, most people are saying we really don't know the long-term effects. And so let's the research continue. One of the big questions we have to face as consumers is what interventions have taken place between the seeds in our mouths? And like the Legos who spoke before us, when you are close to the farmer, you know where the food is coming from. There aren't too many questions, but even a farmer has to wonder where the seeds are coming from. What's the impact of all of this new technology on the farmer's ability to do business? And I think that pressure has been tremendous on American farmers as well as farmers all over the world. On American farmers, I think they're taking a beating now because of the international response to genetically engineered products. The American Corn Growers Association has come out and said that they do not support genetically engineered foods and seeds at this point. They didn't take a stand on whether GM foods are safe or not, but in the interest of their farmers, and I think having access to markets, they decided to take that position. The British Medical Association has supported a moratorium on these products. So I think that what we're consuming is a big question right now. And Jane Andrews spoke about being consumer-driven, and I think that that's an important thing for anyone in business. But as a consumer, both a homemaker and a professional, I have to try to put together the whole picture as best I can, both as a citizen and as one who consumed. I don't like being called a consumer. We all consume, but being a consumer means that, well, you know, you're part of the marketing campaign. And so if there's consumers and producers, my own point of view is I consume what I need as little as possible. I consume in a way that's conscious of its impact all around me. Taking back our government, one of the biggest problems that I think has occurred in this whole debate is that during the Bush-Quayle administration in the 80s, Vice President Quayle pretty much was leading the charge in a deregulatory process and pretty much made the Food and Drug Administration break its own rules by creating the idea of substantial equivalence. Now, that's not a scientific term, as Margaret Smith explained to me at one point. It's language. It's a concept. It's an idea. But by creating this idea of substantial equivalence, it meant that genetically modified food didn't need to be labeled, which the FDA had always labeled in the past. Substantial equivalence. We know what equivalent means, but substantial. Now, there's the tricky word. Michael Pollan wrote in the New York Times in October 1998, Playing God in the Garden. And I think this statement will pretty much clarify why I believe we need to take back our government. In 1998, the New York Times reported that regulation of the pesticidal potato has fallen through the cracks of the U.S. government. The FDA told the Times it did not regulate the potato because it does not have the authority to regulate pesticides. That responsibility, said the FDA, lies with the Environmental Protection Agency. But the EPA said labeling pesticidal products, potatoes, is FDA's job because potatoes are a food. The FDA responded that the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act forbids the food agency from including information about pesticides on food. And so it goes. Meanwhile, Phil Angel, Monsanto's director of corporate communication, told the Times in that same article that Monsanto should not have to vouchsafe the safety of biotech food. Our interest is in selling as much as possible. Assuring its safety is the FDA's job. So what we have here is a lot of double talk. And I started thinking, well, this round and round, what's it? What could this all be about? I mean, substantial equivalence, I think, is the basis upon which the promotion of genetically engineered foods has moved forward. I don't believe it's substantial equivalent. I think it's significantly different. But I think people will argue here. I think the safety, the potential benefits still have a long way to go in terms of research. But we have, as everyone has said, a long way to go to determine some of the answers to these questions. We need our government to monitor independent research. Right now, the USDA is vested in things like terminated technology and supporting developing agricultural markets in other parts of the world. The USDA is not spending enough time in supporting family farmers, small farmers. They're interested in the big guys. Now, we have to say, well, why is this so? I think the biggest problem we have is that in America, we have the best democracy money can buy. And what we see is a revolving door policy between industry, the FDA, and research centers. Now, I don't mean to blanket everybody in each of these agencies. I know that there are people within research institutions, within business, within government, who are trying to do the right thing. The EPA and USDA, it's been revealed, have actually suppressed and marginalized scientists who raised questions in the early years. So from my point of view, we need a moratorium on the production of GE products for commercial markets. As I said, the British Medical Association supports that worldwide moratorium, and there's a growing movement in this country. New York State has legislation on both the State Assembly and the State Senate. The next issue is patents. Who owns genes and seeds? That's becoming an incredibly critical problem. Can you really own a seed? Can you actually own a living thing that has always been part of our history, our culture? Industry will say, well, we need a way to benefit from our inventions. But they really haven't invented anything. There may be a whole range of discussions about exactly what's been done, chemically separating a gene and blasting it into cell and creating a whole new organism. But inventions, who invented the gene or the chromosomal structure? Again, the idea of substantial equivalence seems to support that idea. I want to give you just one example of a reversal on a patent. W.R. Grace, a multinational agribusiness corporation, attempted to patent the neem tree. It's a tree from India, and it has many, many, many values. As it turns out, all of these patent requests were being made, and the European Union had pretty much taken the patent back, which they had received years before. And so we're seeing more and more questions being raised as to really who owns all of these things. Now, with these issues out there, you know, what do we do? I think there's a number of things we need to do. One is we face our fears. But facing our fears, what fears do we have? There's uncertainty. Do we know enough about genes and transgenic processes? Do we know enough about human physiology, nutrition, to commercialize all of these products? I don't think so. Stop commercialization is another thing I think we need to do. One way you can do that is by supporting organic. Now, obviously, organic foods are much more expensive than other foods because right now, organics make up about 1% of the market in produce sold. But I believe that once organic agriculture really takes off and becomes more available, like anything else, the more supply, the more the prices come down. Challenging the myths. That's a big one, and I think that's where the industry as a whole is trying to go the same route as nuclear power, too cheap to meter, no problems with that. And so facing our fears, stopping commercialization, and challenging myth is what I'm trying to do.
That was Tony Del Plato of the Ithaca Area Safe Food Campaign speaking at a symposium on genetic engineering and food safety presented by the Cornell Cooperative Extension of Onondaga County late last month. More information about the Cooperative Extension programs and the speakers in the symposium will be posted on the Unwelcome Guests website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome.